listening to realclearduff.com.
One Pei Tes Amud Aleph, on the ninth line, the third last word on the line, where it says Amar Abaye. The end of yesterday's daf, we discussed the case of Tovas Hanah by Iksuba. The phrase Tovas Hanah is used by the Gemara, means a small amount of money. As we discussed yesterday, a woman would be able to sell her right to collect her Iksuba for a Tovas Hanah. A buyer would only be willing to purchase, you know, her zchus to collect her ksuba for much less than the actual ksuba amount, and that is because of the fact that if she ends up dying before the husband, then she doesn't collect her ksuba at all. Therefore, one who purchases this right is clearly taking a risk. He's purchasing the right to collect the ksuba amount if and when the husband dies before her or divorces her. And therefore, we learn the halacha. Let's say witnesses come in and falsely testify that a woman was divorced and paid her ksuba. And then the witnesses were exposed to be edim zomim. Other witnesses said, this cannot be true. These people were with us at the time. They couldn't have witnessed this. So now they're edim zomim. And the Torah says, we do to these edim zomim, kasher zomim lasas lachiv. Just as they plotted to do to their fellow Jew through their false testimony. So the Gemara explained yesterday, how much would they have to pay? They only have to pay the Tovas Hanah, because it's not fair to say that their testimony, if it had gone through, would have caused her loss of the entire ksuba. We have no idea if she would have gotten paid at all. So what's the true value that she has, this right to collect the ksuba? The answer is the Tovas Hanah amount, the amount somebody would pay to collect the ksuba if, in the end, she was divorced or widowed by her husband. Not so much the Edim Zomim would pay. The daf today begins with another point about this whole case. Amar Abaye, Abaye said, Tovas Hanah, hol v'asa liyadon, neima b'milsa. Once this subject of the Tovas Hanah amount, the small amount, she'd be able to sell her right to collect the ksuba, once this has come up, we've been discussing this, let's add another point to the discussion. And that is, Tovas Hanah by says, Le'isha havya. If a woman indeed chooses to sell her right to collect her ksuba, the money, the Tovas Hanah money, goes to the Isha, goes to her, as opposed to her husband. Bai says, how do I know? The if you say that, no, the money goes to her husband. You know, the husband controls, you know, most of the money in a halachic marriage. He says, if you say this Tovas Hanah money also goes to the husband, then the halacha we said yesterday doesn't make sense. Why do we require these Edim Zomim to pay for the Tovas Hanah? Lemru la Edim, let the Edim Zomim say to her, we don't have to pay him anything. Mayev sadadinach, for what loss did we cause you? We have this misdamnet la l'tovas hanah ba'alav eshakum inach. Since if you would have sold the rights to collect your ksuba, you would have got that tovas hanah money. You wouldn't have got that money. Your husband would have taken that money. So we caused no loss here. And yet, we learned in the Braisa yesterday that the Edim Zomim do pay her the tovas hanah. So Bai says, must be that the halacha is, if indeed a woman sells the right to collect her ksuba, she keeps that Tovas Hanah money. It's her money. Hence, the Edim Zomim did cause a loss, and therefore they do have to pay her for this false testimony that would have deprived her of the potential Tovas Hanah money. But the Gemara deflects the proof. It says, Amar Rav Shalman, your assumption, Abaye, that if the husband receives the Tovas Hanah money, she will then lose nothing, is not true. Even if the husband technically owns the money, the fact is, had she brought that money home, mishum deika revach besa, it would have brought profit to the home. Even if technically the husband owns the money, the fact is that she would benefit from the additional income for the household. Therefore, it's not a proof, even if we say that Tovas Hanah goes to the husband, it still makes sense that the Edim Zomim have to pay. Even though it wasn't a conclusive proof, the Gemara rules, a Merava, Rava says, Hilchasa da halachis Tovas Hanah le'isha. The Tovas Hanah money, if a woman decided to sell the interest in her ksuba, the money would go to her. Not only that, says Rava, v'ein ha-ba'al ochel peiros. The husband wouldn't even have a right to the peiros, to income generated from that money. That is, as opposed to the halach in general, which says that if a woman inherits, let's say, some property, some money, the halach is that that property, that money, is considered nichse malug, and therefore if, let's say, she inherited some land, she owns the land, but the husband gets the peiros, he would work the land, and he would get to keep the income the land generates as long as they're married. That's halach that the Rabbanan enacted, but here that wouldn't apply. The Gemara explains, my taima. The reason why doesn't the husband get the peiros from this money? Meaning, why don't we say she has to buy some land and the husband gets the peiros from that land as long as they're still married? Gemara explains, because peira takino le rabbanon, peira di peira lo takino le rabbanon. The rabbanon's enactment only covered a regular kind of income from property that she brings to the marriage, as opposed to peira di peira, meaning more like indirect kind of income, as in this case where she managed to generate some cash from her rights to the ksuba. The rabbis never gave a husband rights to that type of income. Rather, only the typical kind of income generated, such as in the case of land, if the land grows fruits, he gets those fruits. But here, she decided to sell her rights to collect the ksuba in the event that he divorces her or widows her. That's not the type of income that the rabbis enacted the husband gets to keep. The Gemara comes back to the Takan of Usha that we were discussing yesterday. Ki asa Rav Papa Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua mi Bei Rav. Rav Papa and Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yeshua, came from the yeshiva of Rav Amri. They said, Tanina le Takanas Usha. We have a proof from our Mishnah to Usha's Takana. Now we understand why the Gemara brought up the Takanas Usha, because now the Gemara connects it back to our Mishnah. And again, as we learned yesterday, the Takan of Usha, if you hold of it, says that the Rabbanan blocked a wife's ability to sell her nechse malug. Her property that the husband just has a kinyan peiros of, if she attempts to sell that, and then she dies, the husband would have a right to seize that land back from the lokech. It's not a valid sale. So Rav Papa and Rav Huna wanted to say that our Mishnah proves the existence of Takanas Usha. For our Mishnah taught us, Eved v'Aisha pigiyas and Ra. It's a bad idea to get involved in a case of injury with either an Eved Kanani or a married woman. For Hachov Bahen Chayiv, well, on the one hand, if somebody injures one of these people, he's Chayiv to pay. But Behem Shechov Lubacherim Peturim, somebody was injured by an Eved or an Isha, in practice, at least right now, he will not be able to sue them because they don't have their own money. The Eved Kanani's money belongs to his master, the Isha's money belongs to their husband. Therefore, he won't be able to collect any money unless the marriage ended. Then he'll be able to sue her. So Rav Papa and Rav Huna point out, if you say there's no takanas usha, the rabbis never said that a wife is blocked from selling nechse malug, meaning she may go ahead and sell her nechse malug. What does our Mishnah mean? She can't pay. Just have her sell her nechse malug. Any properties that she has the title to, have her sell that and use the proceeds to pay for the damages. So we see from the Mishnah that there was a Takanas Usha, and therefore she's not able to sell her Nechse Malug. The rabbis blocked that so the husband wouldn't have animosity if she would go ahead and sell the Nechse Malug. The Gemara responds, L'taymech, even according to you, the Mishnah doesn't make sense. For Nehi Nami, the Issel, Takanas Usha, even if we grant the Takanas Usha, v'lomatzi mezavna legarmi, so that means that she can't outright sell her nechse malug. However, you could still ask, tezavin le nechse malug b'tovas hana v'sitein le. The Takanas Usha wouldn't stop her from making a deal with somebody, that he pays her a little bit of money, and that purchases him the right that should her husband die first or divorce her, this other person will collect her nechse malug. That she could surely do. So let her do that and use that money to pay for the damages. Sela, so rather, what do you have to say to answer this question? And the Mishnah is talking about a case where the Lesla, where this woman doesn't have any Nechse Malug. Yeah, if she had the Nechse Malug, fine, she could get the Tovas Hanah money, but she doesn't have any. Hachinami, the Lesla, so. Now the answer to your original question also is, why can't she sell her Nechse Malug? Because she doesn't have any. But perhaps if she did, there is no Takanas Usha, and she would be able to sell it. So therefore, this is not a proof. The Gemara now says, the Mishnah still doesn't seem to make sense. Why does the Mishnah say that she is unable to pay for the damages, even if you say she has no nechse malug? Still, Tezabin Ksubasa Bitovas Hana Vesitain Le. Let her get the Tovas Hana money, the rights to collect her Ksuba. In other words, she should sell someone else the right to collect her Ksuba, assuming that she's widowed or divorced, for some small amount of money because of the risk, as we explained above. For what if she dies first and the guy won't get any money? But whatever amount she could get for such a sale, let her do that and pay for the damages that way. Mar answers, no, you can't ever sell the rights to Ksuba for Homani. Who is the Mishnah going like? Remarry, it's going like the Tana Rabbi Meir. The Omar Osr Lola Adam Shiashis Ishta Filu Shachas Below Ksuba. Remarry says there is a prohibition for a person to keep his wife, meaning stay married to her, for even 1 hour without a Ksuba. Remarry says it's absolutely necessary that there be a Ksuba at all times throughout the marriage. And therefore, according to Rav Meir, it's illegal for her to sell her ksuba. So that's why the Beis Din can't require her to pay that way. She's not allowed to do that. That's why the Nizik won't be able to get any money that way. But the Gemara says, this doesn't seem to answer the question. But let's go into Rav Meir's rationale. Why does Rav Meir say that it's necessary that there be a ksuba at all times during the marriage? But time am I? What's his reason? Rav Meir's reason is the ksuba provides a very important deterrent from divorce. That is, kedesh lo tehekala be'enav lo tzia. As long as the ksuba debt looms before the husband, he won't be so quick to divorce her. He won't take such a decision lightly, knowing that he'll have to pay a lot of money for a ksuba if he divorces her. Says the Gemara, that reason, seemingly, is not relevant in our case. Meaning you won't have the problem of removing the deterrent if she chooses to sell her rights to the ksuba for the tovas hana money. Hacha here, if she chooses to do that, to pay the nizik that way, lo megarish la, I won't make the husband quick to divorce her. For still, he realizes the megarish la, if he chooses to divorce her, osu hanech dezavni gavula l'ksuba semine. True, she won't collect the ksuba from him, but whoever purchased the right to the ksuba from her will collect it from him. He's going to have to pay the same money either way. So her selling the ksuba doesn't remove the deterrent, so it shouldn't be a problem. This should be a valid path for her to be able to pay for the damages. So therefore, the Gemara suggests a new answer. The Gemara suggests, Ella. Rather, we can say, Tovas Hanah Mili Ninu. Let's analyze. What is a Tovas Hanah? It's not a tangible thing. A Tovas Hanah is selling an intangible right to something. You have a right to collect her ksuba if she is widowed or divorced. So the Gemara says that's called mili ninu. It's mere words. And the Gemara proposes that umili lo mishtabdi. It's such a thing. It's just mere words. It's an intangible. It's not something that could be mishtabdi, that this nizik, this damaged person, could have a lien on. If she has money or property, so the nizik as a creditor, he was damaged, he's a creditor now, he has a lien on her tangible property. But this intangible tovas hana that she could sell, it's not something the nizik is a shibud on. That's why the Mishnah says he won't be able to collect that. But the Gemara pushes back at this. Alamala, why not? Why can't the nizik have a shibud on the tovas hana money? True, it's mere words, as you say. It's an invisible right that she has, but the fact is, these mili are the mizdavni bidinari ninu. It's worth real money. There is an actual market value for this agreement. And therefore, it's something that she owns, and therefore something that the Nizik should have a lien on. So the question returns, why can't the Nizik force her to sell her rights to the Ksuba and have her pay for the damages that way? So therefore, the Gemara says a different answer. Ela mishum de Shmuel. Rather, the problem with this option is because of the halacha that Shmuel taught. Amr Shmuel said, the halacha is, in a case like this, where hamocher shtar chov lachavero, any case where someone is selling a loan document, like say Reuven lent money to Shimon, and they wrote a document saying Shimon owes Reuven money. Reuven needed some cash; the loan wasn't due yet, so he turned around and sold the shtar chov to Levi. So he put Levi in his place. Now Levi has the right; you know, he owns the debt; he can collect from Shimon. Shmuel taught that even if Reuven does such a sale, it doesn't change the fact that Reuven is the actual creditor. And therefore the halacha is, if a chazer machlo, if Reuven turns around and then forgives the debt, he says, Shimon, you don't have to pay me anymore. The halacha is machul. The debt is indeed forgiven. And now Levi can't collect from Shimon. I'll have to try and sue Reuven now. Shmuel says, v'afilu yoresh machul. Even if, let's say, Reuven had died, and Reuven's heir came along and waived the debt, he says, Shimon, don't worry, you don't have to pay the estate this money. even that would be effective in forgiving the loan, and Levi then would not be able to collect from Shimon. So in other words, such a sale carries a great risk. You know, Levi should be aware that if Reuven turns around and is mochel the debt, he won't be able to collect from Shimon. So the Gemara suggests, because of this halacha, we do not go with the option of requiring this woman to sell her ksuba to someone, just sell the debt that she's owed of her ksuba to somebody else, and then use the money to pay the nizik, because that might mess up the purchaser of the debt. For what if she then decides to turn around and forgive the debt, say to her husband, you don't have to pay me a ksuba. If she did that, then the purchaser would be out on his money. So we don't want to do something which could cause this outside person a loss. That's why this is not an option. The Gemara says, what's the problem here? Amri, they asked, what do you mean? Why not do this? Why not zivuni zavin viti tenle? Let her sell her debt. Sell her rights to the ksuba and take that money and pay the nizik. The nizik will definitely be paid. Now what's your issue here? Maybe she'll forgive the debt and mess up this lokeach. Well, I'm sure the lokeach is aware of that possibility. If that happens, v'yimachla le'legabe ba'al timachla, if she indeed went ahead and forgave the ksuba, then, okay, nu, what's done is done. She forgave the debt, and the lokeach surely was aware of that risk. And the Gemara's question is that your concern is a mere possibility. Maybe she'll forgive the debt and mess up the lokeach. The Gemara argues it doesn't seem to be such a high price to pay if we'll enable her to definitely pay the nizik. At least the nizik will definitely get paid. Maybe in the future there'll be a problem. We'll worry about that then. The Gemara answers no. The issue here is like this. Amri, they explained that this is not just a maybe. Maybe she'll be mochlet. Rather, kol legami bal vade mochlele. There's no question. If she were to sell her ksuba to somebody else, she's definitely going to go ahead and forgive the ksuba debt to do her husband a favor, with the result of causing this purchaser a loss. And this is not a situation that we would want to create. Mafsedine lahu zivina biyadayim lo afsedinu. To be a dayim, to, in effect, directly go ahead and cause this purchaser a loss. Again, why? Because we are certain she's going to turn around and forgive the debt. So for us to allow such an option would, in effect, be going and be a dayim causing somebody a loss. We're not going to do that. That's why this is not an option. Right now is a new question. Chitema, if you'll say, one second here, why not forget the middleman, forget this other purchaser, why not have this woman who, you know, the nizik has nothing to lose, he is faced with either getting nothing, or maybe we can at least do something, meaning, let her be zavina nihale le'ahu d'chav lebe'be tovasana. Let her grant the right to collect the ksuba to the nizik himself. Cut out the middleman, and pay the nizik by granting him the rights to collect her ksuba in the event that she's widowed or divorced. For the Gemara argues, turning to Amid Beis, the imachlo legabe bal. If your issue is, well, maybe she'll forgive the debt, but so what? Loka mafsid, they wouldn't result in a loss to the nizik. The hash the namilo midik yavile. As it stands right now, he's not getting anything. So it's a choice between zero or maybe he'll end up receiving something. Maybe she won't forgive it, and he'll receive the ksuba, and she'll pay for the damages. So maybe you'll say, why not do that? The Gemara says, no, there's no point. For sof kol lagabe bal vade machla, as we said, it is a certainty that she's going to go ahead and be mochel the debt as a favor to her husband. She's going to say to her husband, you don't have to pay me the ksuba anymore. And therefore the net result is that the nizik will not be getting paid anything. And therefore, v'truchi beidina b'chidi l'matrachinan. We don't burden the courts for no reason. We don't want to waste the bezdin's time. Doing this would be a waste of their time. The nizik would end up getting nothing because she's certainly going to be mochel the debt. That's why this is not an option. The Mishnah says, as it stands right now, as long as this woman's married, the nizik will not be able to practically get paid. But the Gemara now wonders about the following brisa. L'hadetanya, what about this following brisa? Says, v'chein hi shechav la bebalo. Similarly, if she damaged her husband and he tries to sue her to pay for the damages, the halacha is lo hefsida ksubasa. She's not required to forfeit her ksuba to pay for the damages. So says the Braisa. The Gemara asks, Amai, why is this the halacha? What do you mean? Why isn't she required to forfeit her ksuba? Let her grant whatever value it will be for the right of the husband not to have to pay the ksuba, even if he predeceases her or divorces her. That will only be tavasana. Of course, it's not the value of the entire ksuba, because, of course, it's possible that she'll die before him. whatever amount that is, let her grant that amount to him to pay for the damages. And of course, the whole issue we said above isn't relevant. The Yimachlu Lagabi Baala Kapseida. If she turns around and says, you know what, you don't owe me a ksub at all, there's no pseida, there's no loss, that's actually exactly what the husband wants. That would be a way of paying for the damages, so why not force her to do that? The Gemara answers, Ha vade Rabbi Meir. This halacha, we can definitely explain, is based on Rabbi Meir, who, as we saw above, the Omar Asr La'adim Shiyashis Ishta Filu Sha'achas B'lo Ksuba. Rabbi Meir says, it can't be a moment in a marriage where there's no ksuba. That is why we can't require this woman to forfeit her ksuba. You're not allowed to do that. That's why the Braisa says, Lefsi the ksubasa, she need not forfeit her ksuba to pay for the damages. The Gemara responds to this, so what do you mean? What's her merit? So logic, the reason he's so insistent that there always be ksuba in the marriage is, Kadesh lote kalaben of lotzia, in order for that deterrent to be there. The husband will think twice before divorcing her, knowing that he's going to have to pay a big ksuba. The Gemara says, here, seemingly, that deterrent anyways doesn't exist. Because here, he can just divorce her. He's not going to have to pay a lot of money, because she owes him a lot of money for the damages. And so again, the Gemara seems a bit redundant here. The Gemara says, he's not so concerned over here about having to pay the ksuba, because that gets cancelled out by the money she owes him for the damages. And so the question returns, why can't he make her pay right now by forfeiting her ksuba, since in this case there's anyways no deterrent? The Gemara simply answers that the case that Bryce is talking about is kigon the nafish ksubasa. So the amount of the ksuba is far greater than the amount of the damages, and therefore, the fact that he is able to collect that relatively small amount for the damages, lamaf satuva, will not lead him to decide to lose a lot of money. He's going to have a great net loss because the ksuba is much more. So the deterrent still exists, and that is why it's not an option to ever forfeit the ksuba, for then you're going to remove the deterrent. That's what the braisa means. The Gemara asks, still, doesn't seem to make sense. The Gemara right now assumes that we're talking about a ksuba that does not just include the basic deraisa amount of 200 zuz if when they were married she was a virgin, 100 zuz if when they were married she was an almana. Those basic amounts the Gemara refers to as the deraisa amount. The Gemara assumes that's not the entire ksuba. Usually there's tosefes. The husband adds additional amounts. There's a dowry there. There's amount beyond the basic 100 or 200 zuz that he's going to owe her, should he divorce or widow her. Therefore, the Gemara asks, v'idin nefisha ksubasa miksuba deraisa, assuming that there's tosefes, there's additional money beyond the basic amount, and still it seems there's a way for her to pay him for the damages. That is, nukma ksuba deraisa, keep the basic deraisa amount. No matter what, he's going to owe her the 100 or 200 zuz, depending on if she was a psula or a mana at the time of the marriage. V'idach tezavdan yale b'chavale. Let her forgive the tosefes, the additional amount, commensurate with the amount for the damages. Let her pay him that way. For there, you're not removing the deterrence, because either way, he's still going to have to pay the deraisa amount. The Gemara simply answers, the Bryce is talking about a case, kigon de lo nefisha ksubasa miksuba deraisa. We're talking to Bryce about a ksuba which does not have any tosefes. There's no additional amount beyond the very basic amount that applies by every ksuba. So the Gemara says, let's say we're talking about where she was not a virgin at the time of the marriage, she was, let's say, a widow, so that the basic amount is 100 zuz. Says the Gemara, the case is that's the entire ksuba. And therefore, there is no way here to have her pay for the ksuba. As if he'll suggest that she should forfeit her rights to the basic ksuba, that is not an option because we're going like a remarried, that that's usher. She's not allowed to do that, for that would remove the deterrent. And the case is, the amount of damages is less than that 100 zuz. So the Gemara chooses an example. Let's say the damages was 16 zuz, which is 4 gold dinar. There clearly will be a deterrent, as long as the ksuba debt still applies. For Davi Chavale Abazuzi, if the damages amounted to 4 golden dinar, or 16 regular dinarim, then Mishamar Abazuzi, therefore, just because of the fact that he is owed these 4 golden dinar, Lo Mafsid Esrim V'chamisha, he's not foolish. He wouldn't choose to lose 25 golden dinarim or 100 zuz, the amount that applies to the ksuba of an almana. And therefore, since right now there's a deterrent, it's not an option to have her forfeit that ksuba to pay for the damages. You're not allowed to do that. But the Gemara questions this, where it says, Elohad Ditanya, but how, according to this, will you explain the later section of the Braisa there, which says the words, Kishem Shalotim Chorvihi Tachtav, just as it's impossible for a woman to completely sell her ksuba as long as she is under his dominion, she's still married to him, Kach Lo Tafsid Vihi Tachtav. So too, the rule is, you can't make her lose her ksuba while she's married to him, even if, let's say, she damaged him. The Gemara points out, according to the way we're explaining the Braisa, this statement, which is like a sweeping statement, is not always true. Veha zimnin mashkech la demafsida. Sometimes she will have to pay from the ksuba. Vechidami, what would that case be, based on our above discussion? That would be the halacha if kigon the nefisha ksubasa miksuba deraisa. In the very common situation, where ksuba consists not just of the basic deraisa amount of, let's say, 100 zuz, no, there's more than that. There's additional amounts. There's tosefes. Based on the above discussion, we're saying that the halacha in that case would be that she indeed would have to forfeit the amount of that tosefes commensurate with the amount of damages. And yet, the Braisa makes this like sweeping statement that no, we never make her lose the ksuba to pay for damages. So there seems to be a problem. To answer this question, Amar Rava, Rava says that this later section of the Braisa is talking about a whole different subject. That is Seifa Asam the Ksubas Benin Dichren. This later section of the Braisa is saying something about the halacha called Ksubas Benin Dichren, which is a provision of the Ksuba that the Rabbanan enacted of Benin Dichren, means male children. And the provision the rabbis enacted was as follows. The rabbis were concerned about a father who's deciding on the size of a dowry to give his daughter. The father might be concerned. Since in those days it was typical for a man to take more than one wife, he says, what if my son-in-law takes another wife and my daughter dies before her husband? Then the husband will inherit her. And then after he dies, you know, after all the parents die, the sons from this other woman will end up getting part of my estate. I don't want my estate going to them. So because of this, maybe he'll withhold from giving a dowry. So therefore the rabbis enacted Ksubas Benin Dichren, a provision that guarantees that the estate that the father granted for the dowry for his daughter will remain with his grandsons. That is, on the assumption that his dowry is greater than the dowry of the second wife that his son-in-law takes, the rabbis enacted that once all the parents die and it's time to divide the estate, the sons from these two women do not simply split the entire estate, rather, first, each of the sons take the amount of their mother's ksuba, which will include that dowry that their grandfather had given their mother. After each of the sons take the ksuba amount, then they divide the remainder of the estate. And therefore, the grandfather will be happy in knowing that his dowry will remain with his grandsons through his daughter, and the other male sons won't get it. Now, the Gemara in Ksubas discusses what happens to this provision in a case where a woman decided to sell the rights to collect her ksuba. She needed cash, and therefore she sold to somebody else the right to collect her ksuba in the event that she is divorced or widowed. And then in the end, she died before her husband, so the purchaser got nothing. The question is whether the provision of ksuba has been in Dichrin remains in place. After all, this woman decided to sell her ksuba, so maybe she forfeited her right to the provision of ksuba has been in Dichrin. The Gemara there concludes that no. She doesn't forfeit her right because she only sold the ksuba as a last resort. She needed the cash. But she was not forfeiting her right to the ksuba's benin dichren provision. And so Rav explains that our Braisa is dealing with this subject, v'hachi kitani. And this is what the Braisa is teaching. The Braisa says, kishem shehamocheres ksubasa le'acherem, just as the Gemara in Ksubas concludes, if she sold her ksuba to somebody else. Lo hefsi the ksuba has been in dichrin. She did not thereby forfeit the benin dichrin provision, and her sons exclusively will take her ksuba once she dies and then her husband dies. My time, why do we say she didn't forfeit the ksuba has been in dichrin? Because she wasn't totally giving up the ksuba. Rather, zuzi udan sua. She was forced to do this. She was desperate. She needed the cash. Just as that is the halacha in that case, kach mocheres ksubasa lebala. So is the halacha, even if she had sold the ksuba to her own husband, which, by the way, we said above, according to Rav Meir, is illegal. Let's say she did that, she sold the ksuba to her husband. Now that means she's definitely not going to receive a ksuba. For if she dies first, of course, there's no ksuba. By selling it to the husband, that means even if he dies first or divorces her, she's not paid the ksuba. Even in that case, the Braisa says, lo efsi de ksubas benin dechren, she doesn't forfeit the ksubas benin dechren provision. And upon the husband's death, her sons exclusively will inherit that ksuba amount, my taima. So the reason for we say even in this case, Azuzi Udansua, she was forced to do this because she needed the money, and so she totally gave up the ksuba. But it doesn't mean she was giving up everything, she was not giving up ksubas benin dechren, and so that will remain in place. That's what the Braisa means. So according to this, we can keep the explanation we said above, that the Braisa's earlier statement, and that she doesn't forfeit her ksuba to pay if she damaged her husband, that's referring to a case where there's only a ksuba of a basic deraisa amount, in which case you can't have her forfeit the ksuba to pay for that, since you would then be removing the crucial deterrent that a ksuba provides from the husband divorcing her. The Gemara now comes back to Takanasusha, and the Gemara says, Lema Takanasusha Tinoihi. Let us say that whether this Takanas Usha is the accepted halacha is a dispute of Tanayim. The Tanicha, that for one braisa taught that the halacha is Avde Melug, a case where a married woman has slaves, and they're Avde Melug, meaning they're in the category of Nichse Melug, where she owns the guf and he owns the paris. She has title to them, he has the right to benefit from them, have them work for him, as long as they're married. This braisa taught the halacha is yotzin mishen v'ayin leisha. The law that the Torah states that if a slave's master knocks out the slave's tooth or eye, then the master has to set the slave free. That applies if she knocks out his eye or tooth, avalo leish. But that doesn't apply to the husband. So meaning the braisa is saying she is the true owner. Therefore, she is the true owner, has this halacha. If she knocks out the tooth or the eye, she has to set the slave free. The husband is not really the owner, he just has the peros, and therefore if he knocks out the slave's tooth or eye, the eved does not have to be set free. V'tanya idach, a different braisa says, lo le'ish v'lo le'isha. Neither the man nor the woman will be subject to the law of the shein v'ayin. If either of them knocked out the tooth or eye, the slave would not have to be set free. So the question will be, what is this braisa saying? The Gemara says that the Rabbanan were bringing this proofs of Ruah, they assumed that the Kuli Alma Kinyan Peres Lav Kinyan HaGuftami. That both Braisos agree that owning Peres, which is what the husband owns, he owns the rights to income generated by the Eved, is not tantamount to owner of the title. So meaning you cannot argue that the husband is, you know, a significant owner here just based on the fact that he has Kinyan Peres. Therefore, Gemara suggests, my love, it would seem b'hakim miflugi. Seemingly, this is what the braisas are arguing about. The mandia meliisha, the first braisa, said the law of shein va'ayin does apply to the woman. It's because braisa number one is less late to konasusha, is not hold of to konasusha, and therefore it's simply a situation where she's the real owner. He just has the peros. And so if she knocks out the tooth or eye, slave goes free. Whereas the mandia meliisha v'liisha, braisa number two that says even if she knocked out the tooth or eye, would not go free. That braisa is Islay Takonas Usha. That braisa holds of Takonas Usha, which states that the rabbis elevated the strength of the husband's ownership to the point where if she attempted to sell the Nichse Melug property, or in this case, the Avdi Melug, the sale wouldn't work. So that shows that the husband is a very significant co-owner. And it's a type of split ownership where we say neither of them really is the owner. And as such, neither of them is subject to the law of shein v'ayin. Neither of them is the, you know, complete master. So even if the isha knocked out the tooth or eye, he would not go free. The Gemara responds, lo, you don't have to say that's the dispute. For we could say, the kuli alma is lehu takanas usha. Perhaps everybody agrees with takanas usha. And the rabbis did say that the husband has a very strong level of ownership over her Nechse Melug that blocks her from selling her Nechse Melug property. So what is the dispute of the braisa? We could say, Lakan Kodim Takana, here in braisa number one, where it says that she's the real owner, that's talking about before the Takana. The braisa was taught before the Takana Susha was made. Whereas Kan La'acha Takana, braisa number two, is talking about post Takana Susha. And therefore, that higher level of the husband's ownership, splits the ownership in a way where neither of them would have to set the slave free for knocking out the tooth or eye. Or the Gemara suggests, if you want, you could say, both brises are post takana susha. V'yisla takana susha, both of them hold the takana susha. So the question then would be, on brisa number one, why if she knocked out the tooth or eye, would the slave have to go free? The husband has a great lien on this eved in the sense that he could block her from selling the eved. So doesn't that prevent this law of the slave going free once his tooth or eye is knocked out? The Gemara explains that in Bryce number one's opinion, no. The husband's lien, even though it's a very strong lien, will not prevent the slave from going free should she knock out his tooth or eye. The Gemara explains Kidurava. As per what Rava taught, the Emor Rava also discussed the case where somebody has a very strong lien on some property. It's a case called Apotiki, where a debtor said to a creditor, listen, if I can't pay the money, then you have a specific lien on this specific property. So that's a very strong lien. And yet Rava taught, continuing to Tzadayim and Aleph, by Hegdish, Chametz, Vishichor, in the event that there was a change to the property in question, and either it became Hegdish, it was consecrated, let's say it was an animal, so it was consecrated as a carbon for the base of Migdash, or we're dealing with property that's Chametz, and Pesach arrived, making it totally Aser Ba'ana, it's Aser for any benefit, and therefore not possible to be owned, Vishichor, as well as a case like ours, where you're dealing with a slave, and something happened to the slave, where the Torah says normally he goes free, any of those events would be mafkiyan midei shibud, would remove whatever lien this creditor had on the property in question in the event of either the animal becoming a carbon or the chametz becoming asra and Pesach. These events caused the property to be totally removed from anybody, and this guy's lien automatically goes away. As well as if he had a specific lien on a slave, and the slave is freed, the lien would automatically be removed. The concept is that since the property's essence underwent a fundamental change, it went to the property of the Beis HaMikdash, or it became Aser Ba'ana, or the slave went into a state of shichur freedom, that radical transformation releases any shibud, and the shibud automatically goes away. So that's what's going on. In our case, Bryson number one argues, and so what that the husband has a very strong lien on this Eved? The fact is that the person who has title to the Eved, the Isha, knocked out the tooth or eye, and the Pasuk says that in such a case the slave goes free. So it's a reality, the slave is free, and that Shibud, the husband's lien he had until now from Takanas Usha, automatically will go away. That's what Bryson number one is saying. But the Gemara says if that's what Bryson number one is saying, then apparently Bryson number two argues with this teaching of Rava. So Lema the Rava Tanoihi. Does it mean that Rava's principle is really a dispute of Tanaim? Rava's not going to like that. The Gemara says, "Lo, no, you don't have to say that. The Kuliyama is Lu the Rava." We could say that both Brisos agree with Rava's teaching. V'hacha alamua rabbanon l'shibuda de baal. Here, the question that these two Brisos are debating is how far the Takanas Usha went. To what degree did Takanas Usha strengthen the husband's lean on his wife's nichse maluk? Bryce number two argues that the lien was strengthened so much that it stops the event of the shichur. In other words, it redefines the ownership of the slave in such a way that we say, she is not the true owner. He splits up the ownership. And therefore, it's not the event the Pasuk was referring to. True, if he really would be freed in a way where the Torah really says he's free, it would remove any lien. But such an event did not occur, because the husband's lien from Takanas Usha split up the ownership, so he doesn't go free. That would be Bryce number two's argument. Not that Bryce number two doesn't accept Rav's teaching. The Gemara suggests another way we could explain the dispute of these Brysos, as the Gemara v'Ibai Seymour. If you want, you could say, really, the Kuli Alma less Lahu Lahani Tanai Takanas Usha. Could take a whole different approach, that none of the Brysos agree with Takanas Usha. And meaning the rabbis never elevated the husband's rights to her nechse malug, and really she does have the right to sell her nechse malug. So if so, the question would be on Bryson number two. Why would Bryson number two say that if she knocked out the slave's tooth or eye, he doesn't go free? What do you mean? She's the real owner. He only has a kinyan peiros. The Gemara says, V'hacha b'kinyan peiros k'kinyan aguf dami k'miflegi. These Brysos are actually arguing about the question that we took as a given above. Above we said, everyone agrees that if the husband only has kinyan peiros, that's not comparable to kinyan aguf. The fact that he owns the right to the income is not like having title to the property in question. Says the Gemara, Bryce number 2 argues with that. Bryce number 2, in fact, holds that a kinyan peiros is like equal to kinyan aguf. And as such, it splits up the ownership so that neither the husband or the wife is the real master of the slave. And that's why if either of them knocks at the tooth or eye, the slave does not go free. That's another way we can explain the dispute of these brisos.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD-1. That's 855-275-7231.